Good morning. This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program, hour number two. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour, we will explore some of the world of physics, specifically talking about, at least to begin, one subject, and that is superconductivity. And if you don't know what that is, we'll see if we can make it clearer for you. Simply stated, there are many different materials that will conduct electricity, although under normal conditions, they do also resist the current that goes through them. However, there are some things where if you make them very cold, they lose their resistance completely. Now, scientists have known about this phenomenon for a while, that it was first observed relatively early in the last century, but it was not until 1957 that a group of scientists here at the University of Illinois explained how this worked. This morning in this part of the show, we'll talk about superconductivity and what it means for physics. This is going to be the subject of a conference now taking place over several days here, beginning today on the U of I campus, talking about superconductivity and what it means for physics. And this conference will be featuring talks by 8 Nobel Prize winners, including our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Steven Weinberg. He's professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin. He won the prize in 1979, and he'll be giving a talk on Thursday about this subject here that we'll try and explore in this part of the show. That's at 7:30 in the evening at the Beckman Auditorium, and it certainly is open to anyone who is interested in attending. If you would like to stop by, you should feel welcome. Also, questions here on this program are welcome too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we do also have a toll-free line, so that means anywhere you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Weinberg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, this is I have to admit that physics has never been a strong subject for me, so you'll have to bear with me as I ask some of the most basic questions I possibly can think of. But I expect that there probably will be a lot of people who are listening who will be at that same level. So hopefully at the end, they'll say, well, I think I understand a little bit better than at the beginning. We'll see what we can do.
I'll try.
Was my basic there explanation here just at the head? Do I basically have that right?
Oh, yes. Actually, I think superconductivity was first noticed a little bit later than the 19th century, but otherwise, I think you're right.
Or maybe, did I say 19? I guess I would intended to say it was 1911 when it was.
That's
so
right.
If I said, I must have misspoken there and intended to say, to mean early in the last century,
right.
The 20th century, yes.
Yeah, it was a man named Kamerlingh Ohms who discovered, he was studying a sample of mercury and cooled it down to a very low temperature for reasons I don't know. And he noticed that there seemed to be a short circuit, that current was going through as if there wasn't any resistance, which, of course, seemed silly. And he tried everything to find the short circuit, and then he realized that, in fact, the mercury had lost all its electrical resistance because it was so cold.
Mm-hmm.
And this phenomenon was completely mysterious at the time, and theoretical physicists tried for decades to understand how that was possible. And they discovered other weird things about superconductors, which many people regard as even more characteristic. For example, if you have something like mercury, which is at a temperature warm enough so it's not superconducting, and you have it in a magnetic field, when you cool down the mercury so that it becomes superconducting, it expels the magnetic field. Magnetic fields don't penetrate into superconductors, or at least not into most superconductors. That's called the Meissner effect, after Walter Meissner, who discovered it. And there were other odd properties of superconductors, some of which were discovered relatively recently. For example, if you have a thick ring of a superconducting material, and it has a current flowing round and round it endlessly, which it can do because there's no electrical resistance, that current can't take just any value. The values it can take, the only allowed values are in certain steps. If you want to increase the current a little bit, you can only increase it by a finite amount, not by a tiny amount. Hmm. And the magnetic field going through the ring produced by the current can only have certain values. Superconductivity had the kind of weirdness that naturally attracted physicists to try to understand it, and many people had partial understandings, models that worked, but you didn't know why they worked. It was really only in 1957, as you said, that Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer at the University of Illinois at Urbana figured out what was really going on, and in terms of attraction between electrons and the superconductors forming some kind of collective state which carries electricity without any resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful theory and had a tremendous impact.
Is it, I'm wondering if it's possible to talk about what happens, what normal conductivity is, what superconductivity is, and I suppose for myself, I guess the analogy that I reach for in trying to think about the way current flows is to think about the way water flows through a pipe, and I'm not sure that that is anything like the way electrical current, for example, flows through a lamp cord.
Well, it's not that different. When water flows through a pipe, what you really have, although you don't see it, is individual water molecules, all H2O molecules, all flowing together, jostling against each other, going through the pipe. And there's resistance because they jostle with each other and they bump into the walls of the pipe. So it takes a certain pressure to drive water through a pipe. In an ordinary electric circuit, it's very similar. Instead of water molecules, you have electrons. Electricity is usually carried by metals, and the characteristic of metals is that the electrons can get free of the atoms in which they're normally residing and flow. And they flow along, but they do collide with atoms, and so there is a certain amount of resistance normally, just as in a water pipe. What happens in superconductivity is sort of weird, that pairs of electrons with certain definite momenta, not any momentum, but certain definite momenta, join up, and then they get into a state where they can flow, and they can't be scattered or jostled without a rather large amount of energy, and that energy just isn't available. So they just flow without any obstacle at all. They can go flow forever through a closed ring.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That idea that you could take a superconductor and you could put it in this state, and you could make a closed loop, and in a sense you could inject some electrons into that loop, and that if you did that, they would circle forever?
Well,
or almost forever?
Yeah, I guess almost forever. I really don't know what the ultimate limits on that circulating current are. I should say, by the way, before you ask some questions that reveal my own lack of knowledge, I'm not an expert on superconductivity. I've written in my career exactly one paper on superconductivity, and it was greeted by the community of experts with the indifference that it really deserved. It was a paper of monumental unimportance. My expertise is in a quite different area, the theory of elementary particles and cosmology. And I'm invited not as an expert on superconductivity, and that's not what I'm going to be talking about. I'm invited to this meeting because superconductivity not only was fascinating in itself, but the ideas underlying the theory of Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer turned out to be extraordinarily fruitful in the theory of elementary particles. Mm-hmm. It's not that what they learned about superconductivity could be applied to elementary particles. I mean, the phenomena are completely different. We're dealing with particles that interact at very high energy. We're dealing with the laws of nature at a very deep level in elementary particle physics. But there are mathematical ideas that were developed in the theory of superconductivity, which when elementary particle physicists learned about them, turned out to have an explosive effect. Suddenly, progress began to be made in areas where we had been stalled for many years. One of the other speakers at the meeting, Yoichiro Nambu, is one of the first persons who realized the implications of the theory of superconductivity. And I guess he was the first, really, who started to apply not the theory of superconductivity, but the ideas that had been developed in making that theory, started applying that in the theory of elementary particles.
Yeah. Well, I think it's certainly what I expect for a lot of people listening to our conversation. We will very quickly get to the limit of what they either want to know or need to know about superconductivity. As you say, I think probably for most people, the question, once they essentially grasp the idea, the question is going to be, so what? And that is, what does it mean to physics, the fact that we know that this happens and we know why, we know what's going on.
Well,
What can you do then with what you know?
Well, I think the most important thing that came out of the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory was the realization that superconductivity is something that can be understood on the basis of known particles and known forces. That wasn't clear. In fact, in 1933, Walter Meissner, who was the discoverer of the Meissner effect, the expelling of magnetic fields by superconductors, wondered whether or not the electric currents in a superconductor were actually carried by known particles, like electrons, or whether you would have to invent something entirely new to physics in order to explain superconductivity. The great thing that BCS did, Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer, was to show that superconductivity could be understood without introducing any new elements into physics. They introduced new ideas on how to understand the behavior of electrons in certain metals, the way they interact, and this weird property of carrying electric current without resistance. There were plenty of new ideas, but there was no new underlying physics, no new particles, no new forces. Mm-hmm. That was very important to find out. Otherwise, superconductivity would be at the top of the agenda of elementary particle physicists who are trying to push back our understanding of nature at the most fundamental level. And we discovered it isn't. It's a very weird and beautiful phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon that arises out of ordinary particles that we know about and ordinary electrical forces and other forces acting on those particles. So that was a big, if you like, a negative result, that in a way there was nothing new there. But what was new were the ideas, and there was one idea in particular, and this is what was picked up by Nambu, an idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which I think I have to explain a little bit.
Okay.
A symmetry principle is a statement that something looks the same from different points of view. For instance, if you look at a sphere, it has the same appearance whatever direction you look at it from. That's not true if you're looking at a cube. That has a different set of symmetries. There are only certain directions in which a cube looks the same. But the laws of nature have certain symmetries. One of them is the symmetry under rotations. You can rotate your observing apparatus, and the laws of nature you discover will be the same as someone else who uses apparatus that are lined up in a different direction. Nature doesn't have any built-in sense of direction. That's a symmetry principle. It's a symmetry under rotations, changes of orientation in space. Physicists have been exploiting these symmetry principles for a long time, and a lot of atomic physics rests on symmetry principles, like the one I just mentioned, the symmetry under changes of direction. Now, when I say spontaneous symmetry breaking, I mean that although the laws describing some material or some system may have a symmetry, a principle of invariance, the phenomena themselves don't. And a classic example is magnetization. The laws that govern the iron atoms in a bar of iron are completely symmetrical with regard to direction. But if you cool iron below a certain temperature, 770 degrees Celsius, it begins to be a magnet, and all the spins of all the iron atoms line up and point in the same direction. And you have a magnetic field that points in that direction, so that the symmetry under changes of direction, changes of orientation, is broken. It's broken spontaneously. You don't need to turn on an external magnetic field to magnetize iron. When you cool it below 770 degrees, it'll become a magnet. Now, what Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer discovered, although they didn't emphasize it, it was really implicit in their theory, is that in superconductivity, you have one of these spontaneously broken symmetries. The symmetry is not rotation in three dimensions, it's rotation in two dimensions, and the little two-dimensional directional arrows that the symmetry acts on are not directions in space. They're the two components of the quantum field of the electron, and if that probably isn't getting across, just think of it as some kind of two-dimensional rotational symmetry inside the superconductor, that when the superconductor is cooled below its critical temperature, that symmetry is broken. But that's an exact symmetry of the underlying theory, and it has implications that are exact. This is no longer depending on some kind of approximate dynamical model. This is something you can prove exact theorems about because you're relying on the breaking of an exact symmetry. And one of the consequences is that in a superconductor, you have these excitations, which BCS described as correlated pairs of electrons, that can flow without any resistance. Mm. Let me put it even more strongly. A superconductor is nothing to a theorist like me, although I don't think Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer would have said this. A superconductor is nothing but a place in which this particular symmetry is spontaneously broken. And all of the properties of superconductivity follow from that. But including its exact zero resistance and the exact values of the allowed electric currents flowing in a ring and certain other exact properties, the fact that the magnetic field deep in a superconductor is exactly zero. All of those exact properties follow from this broken symmetry. This is the way I, at any rate, and in my own treatise on particle physics, this is the way I describe superconductivity. This is the way I think of it. This doesn't really add much to what Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer already did as far as superconductivity is concerned, but this idea of spontaneously broken symmetry turned out to be the clue to an awful lot that we didn't understand in elementary particles, and in particular, it is the mechanism by which elementary particles get their mass. This is a theory due to myself in 1967 and independently about the same time, Abdus Salam. We developed a theory based on the idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which unified two of the fundamental forces of nature, the weak and the electromagnetic forces, and also accounted for how particles like the electron and other particles that are less familiar get their mass. It is, again, an effect of spontaneous symmetry breaking, the breaking of a symmetry which otherwise would prevent them from having mass. And this theory has been proved correct by subsequent experiments and is now part of the basic standard model of elementary particles that describes how all matter and all forces other that are known other than the force of gravity behave. And this was pretty important in the history of elementary particle physics, but the insight about the importance of spontaneous symmetry breaking came from the theory of superconductivity, the 1957 theory of superconductivity.
Here, let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus at 580. We're talking with Steven Weinberg. He's professor of physics at University of Texas at Austin, who received Nobel Prize for his work in physics in 1979. He is one of a number of people who will be here on the campus over the next couple of days to mark the golden anniversary of the publishing of the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer Theory of Superconductivity, and that named for John Bardeen, a physicist who was here on the campus for a number of years, the only person to have won two Nobel Prizes in physics, first for the work that he and others did, in developing the transistor, and the second for this thing here we're talking about, the BCS theory. It was also the result of the work of two other people, Leon Cooper and John Schrieffer. Bob Schrieffer. They were here in this campus, and they did this work. And as I said, it was published in 1957. So the folks here on this campus are marking the golden anniversary of this and what it means for our understanding of superconductivity, and also the larger contributions that then that understanding make for other areas of physics. And let me mention one more time that our guest, Steven Weinberg, will be giving a lecture at 7:30 in the evening in the Beckman Auditorium. That will be on Thursday. And then, of course, there will be a number of other things going on as part of this. So questions are welcome here on Focus 580-333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to call in and hear and talk with our guest. And we do have someone here ready to go in Urbana. This would be line number one. Hello.
Oh, yes, hello. Dr. Weinberg, it's a distinct honor to talk to you. I've read your stuff over the years, not so much your popular literature as well as some of your papers. You're an amazing, amazing mind.
No, thank you.
But I would like to ask you, physics sort of is all one subject in a sense, but I noticed that at CERN they're going to look for the Higgs boson, mm-hmm. and they've had some problems with the, I read this in the literature from the physics community. Do you know when they'll get around to doing that? I mean, I know they have some problems with magnets. Do you have
an idea? Yes, well, it should be next year that mm-hmm. the Large Hadron Collider, a big accelerator, that's just now being finished, will start operations in Switzerland near Geneva.
Yeah.
And that's the prime target of – that's the one particle mm-hmm. that they're reasonably confident will be there and that they will find. It is a particle that was actually predicted by the theory of Salam and myself that based on earlier mathematical work of Higgs and some other people, that we predicted in our 1967-68 paper. In fact, the importance of this is that it answers a question in elementary particle physics that was answered by Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer in superconductivity. The question is, how do these symmetries get broken? In the theory of Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer, it's a actual force mm-hmm. caused by sound waves exchanged between electrons that binds them together into a collective mode. In the electroweak theory of Salam and me, these the symmetry is broken by fields that we put into the theory at the beginning, some of which turn out experimentally to be what we call now Higgs bosons. And the discovery of the Higgs bosons will confirm that picture of how the symmetry is broken. There is another possibility, which is in the back of our minds, and that there won't be a Higgs boson.
That sounds real interesting.
And that because there is also a possibility that the symmetry that I'm talking about, the symmetry that underlies this electroweak theory, is broken much more like the symmetry in superconductors by strong forces acting among various particles. This is an idea of Leonard Susskind of Stanford and myself, and Lenny Susskind named these forces technicolor forces. We don't know that these forces exist, and we don't know what particles they would act on. They certainly don't act on any of the known particles. And the whole idea is maybe a little far-fetched. It runs into various problems, but it is still an open possibility. And if this is the idea, in other words, if elementary particle physics is even more like superconductivity than we thought, then you will not have Higgs bosons. What you will have is a whole variety of other particles, which could also be discovered at the Large Hadron Collider. And so one way or another, it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
My guess is probably they're going to discover one or more Higgs bosons.
Are you going to actually be there, or will you?
No, they don't need me.
You're the theoretician.
I'm a theorist.
And I just want to say again that when I've read your stuff over the years, it's so amazing how you think. I mean, it's just really hard to imagine. Just what you talk about in your public discourse now, you know, even if you try to, it's just amazing how you put things together in your mind. I'm just so impressed, and I'm very,
very
happy.
Thank you very much for them kind words.
Well, I mean, but it's
what I find amazing
the truth.
Are these experiments these fantastic feats of technology to send protons going round and round in these rings with energies up to 8 trillion volts, and then have them collide and study collisions that are going on, 100 million collisions a second, and actually sort out what's happening. Wow.
Yeah.
That impresses me.
Yeah, and I'm impressed with the technology, but also, you know, the way in which you theoreticians work, and that you set up the notion or the idea, and they say, well, let's prove this thesis. And that is very important, because in science, as you well know, that it's sort of a usurpation of all the old philosophies. I mean, one of the things in early physics was, you know, if you can't get a demonstrable methodology, it's just philosophy. I mean, if you read that back into the 20s and 30s and stuff, you have all these arguments about quantum mechanics and stuff. But I just really, really appreciate you, and I really am so happy I've been able to talk to you.
Oh,
you are
you
just
very
a,
much.
An amazing person, and everybody should know that, even though most people probably have no idea what you're talking about. But thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the
call. Bye.
Well, I need to correct some incorrect information that I gave about our guest talk. I got the day right and the time right, but I didn't give you the right place. So I want to make sure that I do that at least a couple of times. Our guest, Steven Weinberg, who is professor of physics at UT Austin, will be talking on the subject Lessons from Superconductivity. This is an event in the MillerCom series, so it's free, open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend is welcome. It will be on Thursday, 7:30 in the evening, and this will be in the ballroom of the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, which is on South Lincoln in Urbana. So different, same time, same day, different place. So I definitely want to make sure that I give the correct information there, because I'm sure
I'm glad you corrected that so that I go to the right place.
We want to make sure he's in the right place, the audience is in the right place, because I'm sure that there will be people who will want to go and hear the talk. So I want to get the right information out there. My apologies there for giving the wrong information. Well, you know, if you wouldn't mind asking something even more basic that goes to this, the thing that you're really interested in, particle physics, I guess I'm of the age where, at least when I think back to the very first things I was taught about what everything around us is made of, there were these smaller and smaller things, and you'd break things down to the point where you got molecules that were collections of atoms, and then you had the atoms, which was the smallest piece of a distinct thing that you could get, and that the atoms were made out of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And
that's still true.
And that's still true, but that what has happened is that we have started to understand that then there are even smaller and smaller pieces.
Yeah, I don't think size is the right way to think of it. It's how fundamental they are, whether they appear as ingredients when we write down the equations of the theory. That, for instance, when we write down the equations that govern matter, we don't have atoms or molecules in the equations. We have elementary particles.
Mm-hmm.
And the elementary particles are electrons. That still keeps its status as an elementary particle ever since it was discovered in 1897. And you said protons and neutrons, and that's almost right, but now we know that they are composed of more fundamental particles called quarks.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, two kinds of quarks go into protons and neutrons called U and D quarks for up and down. Now, those three kinds of particles, electrons, up quarks, and down quarks, are the constituents of all ordinary matter. But they are only the lightest members of families. They have siblings that are heavier, and since they're heavier, they have enough energy so that they can decay into these lighter particles. So, for example, the electron is a member of a family of particles called leptons, and there are other leptons. There is another particle which weighs 210 times more called the muon, and an even heavier particle called the tauon. These aren't present in ordinary matter, although they do occur in cosmic rays. They don't occur in ordinary matter because they're unstable, and they decay into other things, namely electrons. There are also neutral leptons called neutrinos, which travel at the speed of light or very close to it and never come to rest, and so we don't have them in ordinary matter also.
Hmm.
And just there are three kinds of neutrinos. And then the up and down quarks are members of a family of six types of quarks, and they were given letters C, S, T, and B. And these are the ingredients of the standard model of elementary particles. They're all equally fundamental. I think that's an important point, that the fact that something is present in ordinary matter really just means that it's light enough so that it doesn't have enough energy to decay into anything else. The top quark, which was only discovered relatively recently, is just as fundamental as the electron or the quarks that make up the proton and neutron. In fact, our theories treat all of these particles on rather the same basis. These family resemblances go very deep. When I say that the electron has siblings, it isn't just that we like to lump them together in the same category. The theory actually has a symmetry among them, which is broken only by the fact that they have different masses. And that makes the origin of mass even more interesting. So that's what we have. We also then have particles that carry the forces. There's the familiar photon, which carries electromagnetic forces, and it has siblings also, which I think I'll spare you.
Well, how many different subatomic particles are there, round figures?
Well, let's see, six types of quarks, three types of leptons, that's the electron and its siblings, three types of neutrinos, so that adds up to 12, and then four particles of the family that the photon makes up, so that's 16, and then at least one Higgs boson. That makes at least 17.
Hmm.
That's a minimum. And I'm not. And of course, all of the particles that have electric charge have antiparticles with the opposite charge, and I'm not counting that among the 17. I mean, there's an electron, but there's also an anti-electron called the positron, which has the opposite sign of electric charge. But we don't think of that as really something independent. So I would say the minimum count is 17, and could be somewhat larger. In fact, in many of the theories that we're pursuing today, which are highly speculative, that go way beyond the Standard Model, there are lots more particles. All of these families have other family members of different types that are spinning in different ways, and if that's true, there's going to be a very rich set of phenomena discovered at the Large Hadron Collider. One of the reasons for building it is to see if it's true. We just don't know. These are very speculative theories. And it may be, and in a way this is the biggest payoff of all if it happens, it may be that one of these new particles that we speculate about will turn out to be the particle that makes up what astronomers tell us is the dark matter that makes up most of the matter of the universe. You know, we now know that only about 1/6 of the matter of the universe is ordinary atoms. The other 5/6 is some kind of mysterious dark matter that doesn't have electric charge and that doesn't interact with nuclei, that just, we only know about it because of its gravitational effects. It does produce gravity and respond to gravity, and in fact, it's the collapse of this matter in the early universe that begins the process that produces galaxies and stars. Well, we've been talking about this dark matter, and on the basis of astronomical observation, we're pretty sure it's real, but nobody knows what it is, what kind of particles make it up. And it may be that among these particles that we hope are discovered at the Large Hadron Collider starting next year will be a particle of a type that would make it a candidate to be the dark matter. And I think we'll be able to measure the properties well enough in the laboratory to confirm that it is the particle that makes up the dark matter, if it is, or show that it isn't, if it isn't.
As we, as physicists, as people who do the kind of work that you do, learn more and more about the physical world and how things behave and perhaps why they behave the way that they do, are there practical applications that go beyond our simply having a more complete knowledge of the physical world and how it works?
Well, it's hard to say. Certainly, superconductivity has had enormous practical applications. In fact, I don't know if you would call this a practical application, but the magnets that go into the Large Hadron Collider are superconducting magnets, and we couldn't build the accelerator without them. Superconductivity allows all kinds of technology, which is very... But I think you're probably asking about elementary particle physics, the kind of thing that I do for a living. I can sort of weasel out of the question by saying that the experiments that are done, not by me, but by the experimental particle physicists, push technology to the point where we learn all sorts of things about how to do things technologically that turn out to be practically very important. I mean, one example that we're fond of quoting is the fact that the World Wide Web was invented by elementary particle physicists as a means of exchanging data between different laboratories. But that, you know, this is what we call technological spin-offs. The knowledge itself, it's hard to see how that's going to have practical applications. It might. I mean, I can imagine certain kinds of particles that, if they were discovered, would allow, for example, fusion reactions to provide power. But, you know, that's very far-fetched. We don't do the work for that reason. We don't do it for because we want to produce technological spin-offs, and we don't do it because we hope that the knowledge produced will have practical applications. We do it because we're trying to understand nature at the deepest possible level.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of tacit bargain between the scientists who want to push the frontiers of knowledge and the public who are hoping for some technological applications, perhaps from spin-offs from the experiments. It's beginning to get a little frayed, this bargain, at the edges, because the experiments are getting so expensive. And in fact, we saw in the United States the cancellation of an accelerator, which would have been much more powerful than the Large Hadron Collider and would have been completed several years ago, and we would already have the answers to the questions we're seeking. I'm referring to the
superconducting
supercollider that was going to be built in Ellis County, Texas. That was really a traumatic for many of us. We realized that we particle physicists had not really convinced the public that what we're doing is so interesting and exciting that it needs to be supported.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, at the same time that the supercollider was up for consideration for funding, the International Space Station was up for funding. It's much more expensive, 3 or 5 times more expensive than the supercollider would have been, maybe even more than that, and produces nothing of any scientific value at all. So I'm a little bitter about the fact that the supercollider went ahead and is being built and turns out to be, like much of the manned spaceflight program, of no scientific value, whereas projects of great scientific importance are being canceled by NASA and have been canceled, like the supercollider, in the past. I think we scientists really have to work harder at talking the public into supporting us, but at making what we're doing sufficiently clear to the public and sufficiently interesting to them so that they will want to know what we're trying to find out. And it's hard because there's a language gap. You know, we speak the language of mathematics. I can explain what I'm talking about when I talk about spontaneous symmetry breaking to another physicist pretty easily by using mathematical jargon. And when I talk to someone who isn't a physicist, I have to use metaphors and try to use images that evoke what I'm saying. It's very difficult. But we have to try, and we have to also try to do a better job at education of science in high school, particularly, after all, we think of physics as these great discoveries at the frontiers of physics and astronomy and other sciences as part of the culture of our times. In fact, one of the brightest parts of the culture of our times. And what's the good of saying that if it's a branch of culture that's simply closed to the public? And we have to try to make it not closed.
We have about 5 minutes. I have a caller here I want to get into the conversation. Well, we
sure.
still have some time. And also, just very quickly, I'll mention that our guest is Steven Weinberg. He is professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin. We'll be here on the campus tomorrow to give a talk. And I'll give you the information on that talk here. I do want to bring in the caller, though, someone listening in Geneva. This is line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I'm not too far away from Fermilab, actually.
Yeah, I see.
Hi.
Yeah, how you doing, sir? I understand where you're coming from to a point, but we're in a day and age in this country that we're spending money left and right for things, and everybody wants to know what it's going to do for them. And see, this is what I want to put out to you. I'm an advocate of science. I'm not a science major by no means, but I do, you know, like, for instance, NASA. I think NASA does a great job of what they have, but unfortunately, I do believe their budget is bloated, and somebody's got to give somewhere. I personally think the space station won't get finished because of the overruns and the problems with the shuttle because it's antiquated. So, I mean, it's taxpayers' dollars that I'm paying for. And, you know, basically what, and this is the general reasoning behind what I'm why I'm bringing this up. The general public is to the point where they're paying through the nose for taxes, and they're basically saying, what do I get out of it? You know, unless it's going to produce something that's going to be of some kind of monetary value to them, or maybe it'll make life better. Most people are starting to look at all these projects and go, this isn't worth it, because we're financially strapped as a country right now. And although I understand where you're coming from and I think it would be a great shot, that's one of the reasons why that superconductor got shot down. It's too expensive. A lot of these experiments that scientists keep putting up there, and here's another thing. I know a couple of scientists that, and I saw this on the National Geographic Explorer, where they're all crying about stuff that NASA wants to pull out. And it's just one or two things, but everybody, you know, you can't do that. That's my project. You can't do that. So if you pull one and you don't pull another, you know, it's just, it's unfair no matter what you look at. Somebody's got to suffer.
Okay, well, I sympathize with what you say. If you want to know where I would cut the manned spaceflight program to the bone, because I don't think it produces anything useful in the way of science or any technology that can be used for practical purposes. So that, and by the way, the manned spaceflight program dwarfs all these other things we're talking about. The president's vision of going to the moon and Mars, we're not talking about $1 billion here, $1 billion there. We're talking about nearly $1 trillion. So there's just no comparison. But, you know, what you say strikes a chord. When I try to defend spending on the super collider, I'm very aware that there are lots of things that we need to spend money on that we're not spending money on. There's inspecting our bridges, getting rid of the log jam in the patent office, monitoring drugs after they're approved by the FDA while they're being used, getting control of imports, everything from lead paint on children's toys, the nuclear bombs in freight containers. These are all things we need to do better, or need to do, that we're not doing at all, and we're not doing them because of money. Now, part of the reason that all that we're strapped for money in these things and also for basic science is because we waste money on things like manned spaceflight. But another reason is because of an economic fallacy. People have gotten convinced that when you have tax cuts, you stimulate the economy, whereas when you spend money by the government, whether it's sealing our borders or supporting our soldiers or doing basic science, that's somehow a drain on the economy. And that's just a fallacy. A dollar spent by the government for some public purpose stimulates the economy precisely as much as a dollar given to the private economy by tax cuts. I think if we got away from this this sort of moronic economic theory of supply side economics, we could have a more rational tax policy. We're less taxed than most countries in Europe, and they live pretty well. I think. Call me a tax and spend liberal. I think we need to spend our tax dollars more wisely, and of course I mentioned the manned spaceflight program is something I would cut way back on. But I think that there is a role for large government spending for human needs, the things I mentioned, and also for basic science. Because this is not profit-making science. This is something that if government doesn't do, no one will do. And our ignorance about the laws of nature will just persist. Or the United States will become a scientifically second-rate country, and the great discoveries will be made in Europe and East Asia. And I don't want that to happen either.
Well, that, I guess, we're almost to the point we have to finish, but I guess that would be a significant point. We could probably talk more about that. The, you know, the superconducting supercollider won't be built, but a significant new accelerator is being built. What danger is there to the United States if we say, well, You know, maybe it doesn't matter if we build this. As long as somebody does.
Yeah, well, to a theorist like me, it doesn't matter. I don't care whether I get the information from Switzerland or from Texas. But it is a loss to our country. There's a spin-off from this kind of experimental physics that I didn't mention, which is the most important one. It's the human spin-off. It's the creation of a cadre of technically trained people who are trained at the outer limits of what's technologically possible. And this has proved enormously important to our country in the past. The great advances in weapons in World War II, which allowed us to win World War II, from the proximity fuse to microwave radar to nuclear weapons, which we needed then, those advances were made by scientists who, before the war, had been working theoretically and experimentally on fundamental physics. They were not working on applied problems. If the United States is not going to support basic scientific research in this country, our brightest students will go abroad. They'll be part of the foreign world. Perhaps we won't have them because they won't be stimulated to be students. And our country will become scientifically second rate. And maybe that won't matter at first, but there'll be a time we need that kind of technical talent, and we won't have it.
We will have to leave it there with one more mention that our guest, Steven Weinberg, he's professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin, will be on the U of I campus. He'll be giving a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, Lessons from Superconductivity. That is on the 11th at 7:30 in the ballroom of the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. He's here to take part in a conference marking 50 years of superconductivity theory. Professor Weinberg, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.